A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a full-body scan of seasonal allergies. What causes them immunologically? Is the hygiene hypothesis real? Has prevalence actually gone up? What's the connection to asthma? How non-drowsy are today's antihistamines really? And where does immunotherapy stand right now? That's about 6 episodes worth of material, so let's earn our lunch.
Let's start with what seasonal allergy actually is, because the term gets thrown around loosely. Seasonal allergic rhinitis is a type I hypersensitivity reaction, IgE-mediated, to airborne pollens. Tree pollen in spring, grass in late spring and summer, weed pollen in late summer and fall. Ragweed season is the classic autumn culprit.
The immune system is essentially screaming at flower dust.
That's the emotional summary, yes. Immunologically, it's a two-phase process. First exposure, sensitization. Pollen proteins get picked up by dendritic cells in the nasal mucosa, presented to naive T cells, and under the right cytokine conditions. Lots of IL-4 and IL-13. Those T cells differentiate into Th2 cells. The T cells then tell B cells to class switch to producing IgE specific to that pollen protein. Those IgE molecules bind to mast cells and basophils, and then nothing happens. You're sensitized but asymptomatic.
The first exposure is the immune system loading the gun. The second exposure pulls the trigger.
On re-exposure, the pollen protein cross links two IgE molecules on a mast cell surface, and that triggers degranulation. The mast cell dumps preformed histamine, plus it starts synthesizing leukotrienes and prostaglandins. Histamine hits H1 receptors on blood vessels, vasodilation, increased permeability, that runny nose, and congestion. It hits nerve endings, sneezing, itching. The leukotrienes drive the late phase response, which is why you're still congested hours later.
Histamine is the same molecule that regulates wakefulness in the brain, which is why first generation antihistamines knock you out. But we'll get to that.
But first, the question of why this happens to so many people now. And this is where David Strachan enters the story.
1989, the hygiene hypothesis.
Strachan was an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He published a paper in the British Medical Journal looking at over 17,000 British children followed from birth. He found that hay fever prevalence was inversely correlated with the number of older siblings in the household. More siblings, less hay fever. His interpretation was that larger families meant more cross-infection, more microbial exposure in early childhood, and that this exposure somehow protected against allergic disease.
The old friend's idea. We co-evolved with certain microbes and parasites, and without them, our immune system gets bored and starts attacking pollen.
That's the shorthand. The mechanism is about regulatory T cells, TREGs. When you're exposed to a rich microbial environment early in life, you develop robust TREG populations that produce IL-10 and TGF-beta. These keep FT2 responses in check. Without that training, H2 skews dominant, and you get allergic sensitization. Helminths, parasitic worms, were probably a major part of this. They secrete molecules that directly induce TREGs. We evolved with worms in our guts for millions of years, and suddenly, in the 20th century, they're gone from developed world populations.
Which sounds like a strong argument for the hygiene hypothesis. But you've told me it's oversimplified.
The original framing was basically cleaner homes, more allergies. But the data doesn't support a simple cleanliness equals allergy equation. For one thing, allergic disease has continued to rise even as hygiene practices leveled off. And the real insight came from studies looking not at quantity of microbes, but diversity.
The biodiversity hypothesis.
Elka Hansky and colleagues, 2012, published a landmark paper in PNAS. They studied adolescents in eastern Finland and found that allergic sensitization was inversely correlated with the biodiversity of bacteria on their skin, specifically certain gamma proteobacteria. The kids living in more natural environments with more diverse plant communities around their homes had more diverse skin microbiota and lower allergy rates. Acinetobacter was one of the protective genera they identified. Lactobacillus species also seem to play a role in training oral tolerance.
It's not that you need to be dirty. You need to be exposed to the right microbes, the ones from soil, from animals, from natural environments.
And the most striking demonstration of this is the Amish-Hutterite study. Both groups are genetically similar. They descend from the same Anabaptist migrations. Both have large families and avoid many modern lifestyle factors. But Amish children have about 4 times lower asthma and allergic sensitization rates than Hutterite children. Amish farming practices are traditional. They keep animals close to the home, children are in and out of barns, there's high endotoxin exposure. Hutterites practice industrialized communal farming with greater separation between living and animal spaces. Stein and colleagues, New England Journal of Medicine, 2016, they measured airborne endotoxin levels in Amish homes that were nearly 7 times higher than in Hutterite homes.
That's a natural experiment you couldn't design if you tried. Shared genetics, similar lifestyle, one variable changes, and the allergy rates flip.
It's about as close to a controlled comparison as epidemiology gets, and the immune profiling backed it up. Amish children had more neutrophils and fewer eosinophils, lower IgE levels, and higher expression of innate immune genes.
The hygiene hypothesis isn't wrong. It's just been refined. It's not about being too clean. It's about missing specific microbial inputs that our immune systems expect during development.
That brings us to prevalence trends. Because if it's just about microbial exposure, you'd expect allergy rates to have plateaued once hygiene practices stabilized. But they haven't.
Let's put numbers on this. How much have seasonal allergies actually increased?
NHANES data, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, shows self-reported hay fever in the U.S. went from about 10% in 1970 to 19% by 2010. More recent data puts it closer to 25% of adults, 1 in 4. The ISAAC study, which is the Big International Childhood Asthma and Allergy Survey, Phase 3, published in 2008, showed allergic rhinitis prevalence in children rose from roughly 10 to 15% to 20 to 30% over 10 to 15 years, depending on the region.
It's not subtle. Something is still driving this upward.
Climate change is a major factor. Louis Ziska and colleagues published a study in PNAS in 2011 looking at ragweed pollen seasons in northern U.S. latitudes. They found the season had lengthened by up to 20 days since 1990. And it's not just longer seasons. The pollen itself is more potent. Higher atmospheric carbon dioxide directly increases ragweed pollen production. At CO2 levels projected for mid-century, ragweed plants produce about 60 to 90% more pollen than at pre-industrial levels. And the pollen grains themselves express more of the allergenic protein AMBA1.
AMBA1. That's the one that my nasal passages know personally.
Ambrosia artemisiaefolia allergen 1, the major ragweed allergen. And the mechanism is straightforward. Elevated CO2 upregulates the plant's photosynthetic machinery, and producing more biomass includes producing more reproductive structures, which means more pollen and apparently more allergen per pollen grain. So it's a triple hit, longer season, more pollen, more allergenic pollen.
The planet is literally making itself more annoying.
There's also the pollen storm phenomenon. Urban heat islands extend growing seasons in cities, and diesel exhaust particles can adsorb pollen proteins onto their surfaces, delivering them deeper into the lungs and acting as adjuvants that enhance the allergic response. So urbanization compounds the climate effect.
Which connects us to asthma. Because if pollen is getting deeper into the lungs, that's where the asthma allergy overlap lives.
The atopic march. This is the observed tendency for allergic diseases to appear in a sequence during childhood. Eczema in infancy, then food allergies, then allergic rhinitis, then asthma. About 80% of children with asthma also have allergic rhinitis. The Tucson Children's Respiratory Study showed that early allergic sensitization, especially to multiple allergens, is one of the strongest predictors of developing persistent asthma.
For most kids with asthma, allergies are part of the package.
For most, yes. But here's where it gets interesting, and where a major misconception lives. Not all asthma is allergic. About 20 to 30% of adult-onset asthma is non-atopic. That's from the European Community Respiratory Health Survey.
You can absolutely have asthma and no pollen allergy whatsoever.
Non-atopic asthma, sometimes called intrinsic asthma, doesn't involve IgE or Th2-driven eosinophilic inflammation in the same way. Instead, you might see neutrophilic inflammation or mast cell activation triggered by non-IgE pathways. Triggers include viral respiratory infections, exercise, cold air, irritants like smoke or cleaning chemicals, and aspirin or other NSAIDs.
Aspirin. Exacerbated respiratory disease. That's its own beast.
It's a triad of asthma, nasal polyps, and sensitivity to aspirin and other COX-1 inhibitors. It's not IgE-mediated. It involves dysregulation of the arachidonic acid pathway, with overproduction of cystinyl leukotrienes. These patients often have severe asthma and chronic sinusitis with no allergy triggers at all.
There's occupational asthma. Bakers, lab workers, people exposed to isocyanates.
And cough variant asthma, where the only symptom is a chronic dry cough with no wheezing. The point is, asthma is a syndrome, not a single disease. Allergic asthma is the most common subtype, but it's not the only one. If you're an adult who develops asthma and you test negative on skin prick tests and IgE panels for common aeroallergens, you're not a medical mystery. You're just in that 20 to 30%.
That's useful. The public messaging tends to collapse asthma and allergy into one thing.
Because for most patients, they travel together. And treating allergic rhinitis actually improves asthma control. Meta-analyses show that treating allergic rhinitis with intranasal corticosteroids reduces asthma-related emergency room visits by about 30%. The unified airway concept. The nose and lungs are one continuous system, and inflammation in the upper airway drives inflammation in the lower airway.
Even if you have allergic asthma, aggressively treating the nose is part of managing the lungs.
Which is underappreciated. People focus on inhalers and forget the nasal spray.
Now let's talk about what millions of people reach for when pollen season hits. How non-drowsy is non-drowsy, really?
This is where the pharmacology gets interesting and the marketing gets slippery. First-generation antihistamines, diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl, chlorpheniramine, are small, lipophilic molecules. They cross the blood-brain barrier easily and block H1 receptors in the central nervous system. Histamine in the brain is a wakefulness, promoting neurotransmitter. The tuberomammillary nucleus in the hypothalamus releases histamine to maintain arousal. Block those receptors, and you get sedation.
Benadryl is essentially an over-the-counter sleep aid that also happens to help with itching.
It's actually used as a sleep aid more than as an allergy drug at this point. The problem is that even when people take it for allergies during the day, the cognitive impairment is real. Reduced reaction time, impaired driving performance comparable to alcohol in some studies, and it accumulates with repeated dosing.
The second-generation drugs were supposed to fix this.
They did, partially. The key design feature is that second-generation antihistamines, loratadine, cetirizine, fexofenadine, are substrates for P-glycoprotein, which is an efflux transporter at the blood-brain barrier. PGP pumps these molecules back out of the brain. The drugs get into the bloodstream, block H1 receptors in the periphery, skin, nasal mucosa, but are actively prevented from accumulating in the CNS.
They're not non-drowsy because they don't affect histamine. They're non-drowsy because they can't get into the brain in the first place.
And the degree of brain penetration varies by drug. This is where the Hindmarch study from 1999 is so useful. Hindmarch and colleagues did a double-blind, placebo-controlled comparison of fexofenadine, cetirizine, and loratadine using objective psychomotor tests and subjective sleepiness scales. Fexofenadine at 180 milligrams, which is the prescription dose, though over-the-counter is 180 now too, showed sedation rates of about 1 to 3%, essentially indistinguishable from placebo. Cetirizine at 10 milligrams showed sedation in about 10 to 14% of users.
That's a meaningful difference. 1 in 10 people taking cetirizine feels drowsy.
Cetirizine is a zwitterion. It has both positive and negative charges at physiological pH, which makes it less lipophilic than first-generation drugs, but still more CNS-penetrant than fexofenadine. Fexofenadine is a large charged molecule with very high PGP affinity. It's the least brain-penetrant of the bunch.
If someone wants the least sedating oral antihistamine, fexofenadine is the answer.
For most people, yes. Loratadine sits somewhere in the middle. The third generation drugs, this loratadine, which is the active metabolite of loratadine, and levocetirizine, which is the active R enantiomer of cetirizine, have slightly improved profiles compared to their parents, but the differences are modest. Levocetirizine still has sedation rates in the 5 to 8% range in some studies.
There are intranasal antihistamines now, azelastine, olopatadine,
which bypass the brain exposure problem almost entirely because systemic absorption is minimal. Azelastine is effective within 15 minutes, works on both histamine and leukotrienes, and the main side effect is bitter taste and occasional nasal irritation rather than drowsiness. Olopatadine is similar. These are excellent options for people who get sedation from oral antihistamines or who need rapid onset.
What about the caveats? The fine print on the non-drowsy claim.
Alcohol increases the CNS penetration of second-generation antihistamines by competing for metabolic pathways and potentially affecting PGP function. Liver impairment can reduce first-pass metabolism, leading to higher plasma levels. And there are genetic polymorphisms in P-glycoprotein. Some people have reduced PGP expression at the blood-brain barrier, which means more drug gets into the brain even for fexofenadine. You can't know your PGP genotype without testing, but if you're someone who feels noticeably drowsy on fexofenadine, that might be why.
Non-drowsy is a population-level claim, not a guarantee.
And cetirizine's 10 to 14% sedation rate means about 1 in 8 to 1 in 10 people will feel it. That's not rare.
Let's move to the big one. Immunotherapy. If medications are just managing symptoms, immunotherapy is the only approach that actually changes the course of the disease. Where are we?
Immunotherapy works by inducing immunological tolerance to specific allergens. The two main routes are subcutaneous immunotherapy, SCIT, allergy shots, and sublingual immunotherapy, SLIT, tablets or drops under the tongue. The mechanism is elegant. Repeated exposure to increasing doses of allergen shifts the immune response from FAT2 dominant to ATH1 dominant, induces allergen-specific IgG4 blocking antibodies that intercept the allergen before it can cross-link IgE on mast cells, and promotes ILWT on mast cells, and promotes ILWT cells that actively suppress the allergic response.
IgG4 is a blocking antibody. It's like putting a chaperone between the allergen and the IgE.
That's a good way to think about it. IgG4 binds the allergen, but it doesn't trigger mast cell degranulation because it doesn't bind to the high-affinity IgE receptor. It's a neutralizing antibody. After 3 to 5 years of immunotherapy, IgG4 levels can increase 10 to 100-fold, and the clinical response, symptom reduction of 70 to 80%, can persist for years after stopping treatment.
70 to 80% reduction is huge. That's not symptom management, that's near remission.
For many patients, yes. But let's talk about the barriers, because they're substantial. SCIT typically runs $1,000 to $2,000 per year in the U.S., often requiring prior authorization and variable insurance coverage. SLIT tablets, which are FDI approved for grass pollen, ragweed, and dust mite, cost about $500 to $1,500 per year. Some insurance plans cover them, many don't, or they place them in a high tier with significant copays. SCIT requires weekly injections for the buildup phase, usually 6 to 8 months, then monthly maintenance injections for 3 to 5 years. Each visit requires 30 minutes of observation in the clinic after the shot because of the risk of systemic allergic reactions. Anaphylaxis occurs in about 1 in 2,500 injections. It's rare, but it's why you can't just do this at home.
SCIT is effective but inconvenient and carries real risk. SLIT is more convenient.
SLIT tablets are taken daily at home after the first dose is administered under medical supervision. The safety profile is much better. Severe systemic reactions are extremely rare. The downside is that SLIT is only approved for single allergens or closely related mixes. If you're polysensitized, allergic to trees, grass, weeds, dust mite, and cat, SLIT tablets might cover one or two of those, and you'd need SCIT for comprehensive coverage.
The allergen extracts available are limited.
Standardized extracts exist for cat, dust mite, short ragweed, and a handful of grasses, timothy, orchard, Bermuda. For many tree pollens, molds, and other weeds, you're working with non-standardized extracts, which means potency can vary between batches. It's a century-old technology, Extracts are basically ground-up allergen sources suspended in solution. There's been a push toward molecular and recombinant approaches.
Which brings us to peptide immunotherapy and the newer stuff. CAT-PAD was the big hope for a while.
CAT-PAD. Cat peptide antigen desensitization. Used short synthetic peptides derived from FeLD1, the major cat allergen. The idea was that these peptides would be too short to crosslink IgE and trigger mast cell activation, but long enough to engage T cells and induce tolerance. Phase 3 results published in 2016 in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology showed mixed results, significant symptom improvement at some time points, but not meeting all primary endpoints consistently. As of 2026, it's still not FDI approved.
The mixed results graveyard is well stocked in biotech.
Recombinant allergen vaccines are another approach. Recombinant BET-V1, the major birch pollen allergen, has been through phase 2 trials. A 2023 paper in Clinical and Experimental Allergy showed good safety in immunogenicity, strong IgG4 induction, but phase 3 data isn't in yet. Then, there are allergen-specific T-cell epitope vaccines like Allert for grass pollen, which use synthetic peptides representing the T-cell epitopes without the B-cell epitopes that IgE recognizes. Some promising phase 2 data in 2024 and 2025, but nothing approved yet.
There's the plant-based delivery stuff. I remember reading about lettuce-produced allergens.
The idea is to engineer plants, lettuce, tobacco, to express allergen proteins, then administer the plant material orally to induce oral tolerance. It's clever because it's cheap to produce and doesn't require cold chain, but it's years from the clinic.
As of May 2026, where does that leave someone with moderate to severe allergies who's tired of antihistamines?
SCIT remains the gold standard, especially for polysensitized patients. It's the most comprehensive option with the strongest evidence base, 70 to 80% symptom reduction, disease modification, long-lasting effect. The barriers are cost, time, and the inconvenience of regular clinic visits. Slit tablets are more convenient and safer, but cover fewer allergens, grass, ragweed, dust mite. If your primary allergy falls into one of those categories, slit is an excellent option. If you're allergic to 6 different things, SCIT is probably the better choice despite the hassle.
Neither is a quick fix. 3 to 5 years.
Which is a hard sell when someone is miserable during pollen season and wants relief now. But the long game is worth it. Immunotherapy is the only intervention that changes the trajectory. Antihistamines and nasal steroids manage symptoms. Immunotherapy retrains the immune system.
What about the cost landscape? Is insurance getting better about covering this?
The Affordable Care Act classified allergy testing and immunotherapy as essential health benefits in some plan categories, but coverage varies enormously by state and by plan. Many plans require step therapy. You have to fail medications first before they'll approve immunotherapy. And even with coverage, the copays for weekly visits add up. Some allergists offer cluster immunotherapy, which compresses the build-up phase into a few weeks of multiple injections per visit, which reduces the total number of visits but increases the per-visit time and the risk of reactions.
Cluster immunotherapy sounds like the get-it-over-with approach.
It's not for everyone, higher reaction risk, but for the right patient, it can make SIT more practical.
Let's pull this together into something actionable. If someone listening is dealing with seasonal allergies right now, what's the evidence-based approach?
For mild to moderate symptoms, start with a second-generation antihistamine, fexofenadine, if sedation is a concern, plus an intranasal corticosteroid like fluticasone. The nasal steroid is actually the most effective single agent for allergic rhinitis because it addresses the underlying inflammation, not just the histamine symptoms. Start 2 weeks before your pollen season begins if you know your triggers. The drugs work better as prevention than as rescue.
Pre-treat. Don't chase symptoms.
If you have both asthma and allergic rhinitis, treating the nose aggressively with intranasal steroids improves asthma outcomes. Fewer exacerbations, fewer ER visits. The analyses are consistent on this. If medications aren't sufficient, or if you want to address the underlying disease rather than just managing symptoms, talk to an allergist about immunotherapy. Know going in that it's a 3 to 5 year commitment and check your insurance coverage before you start.
For the person who thinks they have asthma but no allergies, get tested. But don't be surprised if you're in that 20 to 30% with non-atopic disease.
Skin prick testing or serum-specific IgE panels will clarify what you're dealing with. If you're negative for common aeroallergens and still have asthma, you need a workup for non-atopic triggers and possibly a different treatment approach. Non-atopic asthma often responds less well to inhaled corticosteroids alone and may require leukotriene receptor antagonists like montelukast or biologic therapies targeting non-TH2 pathways.
Which biologics are relevant for non-atopic asthma?
Tezepelumab. It blocks TSLP, thymic stromal lymphopoietin, which is an upstream epithelial cytokine. It's the first biologic approved for severe asthma regardless of phenotype, allergic or non-allergic, eosinophilic or non-eosinophilic. That's been a significant advance because previous biologics like omalizumab only worked for allergic asthma, and mepolizumab and benralizumab target eosinophils, which aren't always elevated in non-atopic disease.
Tezepelumab is the Swiss Army knife of asthma biologics.
That's not a bad characterization. It's upstream enough to catch multiple pathways.
Let's zoom out for a moment. We've covered the immunology, the epidemiology, the pharmacology, the immunotherapy landscape. What's the open question that keeps you up at night about all this?
One is climate-driven allergen emergence. As growing zones shift, we're seeing new pollens appear in regions where they didn't previously exist, and populations with no prior exposure and no acquired tolerance. Ragweed is spreading in Europe. Olive pollen is becoming a problem in new regions, and the lengthening seasons mean overlapping pollen exposures that didn't used to overlap. The current immunotherapy model, one extract per allergen, 3 to 5 years of treatment, may not scale to a world where the allergen landscape keeps shifting.
The treatment model assumes a stable allergen environment, and the environment isn't cooperating.
The second thing is whether we can prevent allergies in the first place. The biodiversity hypothesis suggests that early life microbial exposure is protective. There are trials looking at whether probiotic supplementation in infancy or even deliberate exposure to farm-like microbial environments can reduce allergic sensitization. The Finnish Allergy Program, a public health initiative from 2008 to 2018, emphasized tolerance rather than avoidance and saw a plateau in allergy prevalence. But we don't yet have a proven, scalable intervention that prevents the atopic march from starting.
Personalized allergy vaccines might be the bridge. Instead of crude extracts, you get a vaccine tailored to your specific IgE sensitization profile.
That's the direction. Component-resolved diagnostics can already tell you which specific proteins within an allergen source you're sensitized to. For example, whether your peanut allergy is to the heat-stable storage proteins that cause anaphylaxis or the heat-label proteins that cause oral itching. Applying that to aeroallergens and then designing recombinant vaccines that match a patient's sensitization profile is technically feasible. The cost and regulatory pathway are the hurdles. I'd say 5 to 10 years before we see that in the clinic.
Further out, epigenetic reprogramming.
The idea is that allergic disease involves epigenetic changes, DNA methylation patterns, histone modifications, that lock T cells into a TH2 skewed state. If you could reverse those epigenetic marks, you might reset the immune system to a pre-allergic state. There are proof-of-concept studies in mice using HDAC inhibitors and DNA methyltransferase inhibitors, but the specificity problem is immense. You don't want to epigenetically reprogram the entire immune system.
That's the nuclear option.
Probably not one we want to deploy for hay fever.
So to land this, allergies are rising. The hygiene hypothesis is real, but it's about microbial diversity, not cleanliness. Climate change is making pollen worse. Asthma and allergy overlap heavily, but aren't identical. Fexofenadine is your best bet for non-drowsy relief, and immunotherapy works but demands commitment and isn't equally accessible for all allergens yet.
If you're considering immunotherapy, the question isn't whether it works, the evidence is strong, but whether the 3 to 5 year investment fits your life and your wallet. For the right patient, it's transformative.
That's a full meal.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, Russian explorers on the Yamal Peninsula credited the indigenous Nenets people with cultivating a hardy strain of rye uniquely adapted to permafrost, a claim that entered several European agricultural journals. It was corrected in 1752 when a Swedish botanist demonstrated that the rye was actually a wild relative, Alamus fibrosus, that the Nenets harvested but never cultivated.
A misattributed grain on the Yamal Peninsula. Of course there are.
That's going to sit with me in a way I don't fully understand.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtaub. If you've got a weird prompt about allergies, asthma, or anything your immune system is doing that you'd like explained, send it to prompts at myweirdprompts.com. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.